is African News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on African News Tonight.
That was a moment of people's power that changed the course of history.
That was South African activist Cheryl Karalus describing the impact when Archbishop Desmond Tutu invited a white mayor to join a march against the racist apartheid system. Details coming up. Also, seven people were killed in Somalia today when Al-Shabaab fighters attacked a small town close to the capital, Mogadishu. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. Friends and family of recently deceased South African civil rights icon, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, have described him as an impish moral giant at the memorial service in Cape Town. Tutu spent decades fighting against injustice, first against the vicious system of apartheid, which deprived him and millions of black people of basic human rights. In recent years, though, Tutu criticized the ruling African National Congress, the ANC, for not caring about his poor compatriots. Darren Taylor has more.
In the 1980s, when apartheid security forces were unleashing fury on Cape Townships, Tutu stood in the trenches with fellow activist Cheryl Karalus. At the service, she described him as a man who for 90 years survived against all odds.
Father Desmond survived polio as a child, tuberculosis as a teenager, and a few bouts of prostate cancer as an adult. In his opposition to the Nationalist Party government, there were many attempts to assassinate him, but mercifully those did not succeed, as they did with killing many of our leaders.
Karola said some of her fondest memories of Tutu were the stand-up fights they used to have. She recalled one in particular after a church service in 1985.
Father called on all citizens of Cape Town to join him in a march in defiance of the state of emergency after a night in which police had killed a number of protesters in the townships of the Cape Flats. One of the congregants at that service was Gordon Oliver, the then mayor of Cape Town, elected exclusively by only whites.
Karalus and other activists were furious that Tutu had invited an apartheid mayor to an anti-apartheid march.
We demanded to know from him who gave him the mandate to make such a serious decision. He put his hands on his hips in what I called his pink dress, stuck out his chin, his eyes spitting fire, and replied forcefully, "I have a mandate from God."
Karola says the march turned out to be a watershed moment in the battle against apartheid. To have a whites-only mayor at a demonstration for non-racialism in the 1980s, she says, was a powerful symbol, and Tutu had realized this from the beginning.
That was a moment of people's power that changed the course of history. That march gave a big push for what was to become the Defiance campaign led by the Mass Democratic Movement, which I believe contributed largely to get those in power to finally realize that our freedom was unstoppable and that they had to get to the negotiating table and that they had to release Nelson Mandela and other political prisoners.
From then on, says Karalus, other white leaders inspired by Tutu joined black people at protest after protest, like when they and crowds of black people stormed onto whites-only beaches.
Many continued to lose their lives during that defiance campaign, but that did not stop our people. In his inimitable style, he helped us to have the courage to reach out to people like Gordon Oliver and gave to good people like Gordon the clarity and the courage to act in unison with the majority of the people in our nation.
Karalus, like Tutu, criticized the ANC for being obsessed with naked power and self-enrichment and for betraying the solemn promises of freedom made during the struggle against apartheid.
He invoked the ire of apartheid leaders, and he also invoked the ire of our newly elected leaders when he alerted us to the dangers of the gravy train. When those we had elected to lead us in our first democratically elected parliament were discussing their salaries and their perks. And just look at the mess of entitlement and corruption we are sitting with today.
Carolus believes one of Tutu's final wishes would have been for human beings to love one another, no matter their differences, no matter how hard it sometimes is. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Among the foreign dignitaries attending the service was acting U.S. Ambassador to South Africa, Todd P. Haskell, who told VOA that Tutu inspired him and many others in his generation to get into public service. Haskell said the Archbishop's fight for justice included the key concept that there's no neutrality between the oppressed and the oppressors, that if you choose neutrality, in fact, you are with the oppressor. Tutu will lie in state until his funeral on Saturday. His remains will be cremated and his ashes later interred at the cathedral's museum according to his wishes. As opponents of Sudan's military government prepare to hold fresh protests today, security forces cut mobile internet service and sealed off the capital Khartoum from its suburbs. According to the French news agency AFP, army, police and paramilitary patrols crisscrossed the streets of Khartoum while shipping containers blocked the Nile bridges that connected the capital with its northern suburbs and its twin city, Omdurman. The U.S. Embassy has appealed for restraint from the government led by Military Chief General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan. It said the government should respect and protect individuals exercising free speech and urged authorities to refrain from employing arbitrary detention. Pro-democracy activists have kept up a campaign of street demonstrations against the army's October 25th coup, despite a crackdown that has seen at least 48 people die in protest-related violence. An Egyptian court sentenced three leading activists to prison terms for spreading false news undermining national security. The State Department declared itself disappointed with the latest sentences, saying what progress there has been in Egypt lately consists of less punitive treatment for people who should never have been in legal jeopardy at all. VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shenawi discussed these developments with Saeed Sadiq, professor of political sociology at the American University in Cairo.
Sisi government feels domestically and internationally strong enough and strategically important to stand firm and not bow to such repeated foreign pressures which do not serve the cause of the defendants anyway. Many different American administrations used to play such a card of suspending part of the aid under similar excuses, but later released them because of the important strategic relations between the two countries. Egypt understands this game and plays the ball back. The U.S. still needs Egypt strategically on many files, including the Palestinian, Iran, counterterrorism, stability in the East Mediterranean, Libya, and Sudan. So those strategic interests will overt any side diplomatic talk about human rights from the American perspective. And that's why the regime doesn't feel that this pressure is serious.
In September, Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi announced his national human rights strategy. A hopeful few regarded the measure as a positive step for a former general who has been keeping thousands of political prisoners. Skeptics, however, considered it window dressing intended to appease the Biden administration so that the U.S. military aid would continue to flow. Judging by the latest news from Egypt, Is there a serious attempt to improve human rights in Egypt?
If it was to appease the Biden administration, it would be considered a big failure because the White House did not invite Sisi to the Democracy Summit in December and was not convincing for the administration enough to prevent suspending part of the American aid to Egypt. Sisi is feeling strong and well consolidated internally and regionally. And he feels that he controls the Islamists. And this strategy started in 2018, and it was only declared in September 2021. And why he did that? For many reasons. One is that they feel that the regime is no longer under threat like after 2013. He also responds to some of the criticism that was made in Geneva by the United Nations, by other Europeans, by the Americans. And so they felt that they should start this process and make the strategy which will be applied gradually because Egypt faced the worst terrorist wave in its modern history during the period 2013-2020. And that's why there was this criticism at that time and not many people were understanding about the situation. And so the regime felt this is the time I have a strategy and it will not be a push button that tomorrow you will have Scandinavian Nordic human rights situation. It will take time, but at least the regime is presenting a blueprint for an action plan that will start to take gradually. In 2022, it will focus on the civil rights and NGOs in Egypt. This is the first stage.
That was Said Satik, professor of political sociology at the American University in Cairo, speaking with my colleague Mohamed Al-Shenawi. In Ghana, only 16 public schools serve approximately 110,000 children with hearing losses. Members of the deaf community are pushing for more schools for their children. Mavis Ochera in Juwaso, in the Ashanti region of Ghana, has more on the story.
The United Nations estimate that 1 billion people live with disabilities worldwide. Ghana signed and adopted various international agreements, including the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. Yet, most people with disabilities in the country are marginalized and denied access to public services. Among the worst affected are those with hearing losses, and their difficulties begin at an early age. Juventus Dorina is a director for the National Association of the Deaf. He says about 50% of children with hearing impairments are unable to get even a basic education in Ghana. He says, however, that more children with hearing impairments are attending tertiary level schooling than in the past. He says there should be more work to create awareness on the need to bridge the gap and encourage parents to enroll their children in school. One problem, Dorina says, some parents do not even know there are schools that teach children who are deaf. Dorina says the government needs to focus on setting up more schools to help children with hearing impairments. Currently, there are 2 secondary schools and 3 tertiary institutions in the country that admit children with hearing loss. For this report, Dorina spoke through sign language. He said most families, when they have kids who are deaf, they become confused. Instead of taking these kids to school, they take them to traditionalists, prayer camps, trying to get them healed. And I believe that it is because they are not aware they have places for these kids. He says the association has been working to let parents of children who are deaf, there are places for them to start learning. He says because of inadequate support for deaf education in the country, some children cannot acquire the skills they need to contribute to the development of the country. Dorina also called on parents to learn sign language so they can help their children with hearing loss. He says many children with hearing impairments do not have a language they can communicate with until they are enrolled in school. Reporting for VOA, this is Mavis Ochery in Juwaso in the Ashanti region of Ghana.
At least 7 people were killed in Somalia today when Al-Shabaab fighters attacked the town of Balad, north of the capital Mogadishu. Police Captain Farah Ali said the fighters stayed briefly in the town after the attack before leaving. According to Reuters, the attack happened amid a political dispute between the country's president and prime minister. Somalia's international partners worry that the political dispute has distracted the government from the fight against the insurgents. The United Nations and various countries are urging Prime Minister Mohamed Hussein Roble and President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed to settle their dispute. Al-Shabaab, which also targets African Union peacekeeping troops, aims to topple the government and impose a strict version of Islamic law. Uganda border districts are receiving scores of asylum seekers following heavy fighting in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. While some are escaping armed and intercommunal violence that flared up in April, most are escaping fighting in a joint Ugandan DRC army operation against Ugandan rebel groups, Allied Democratic Forces, ADF. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
The new asylum seekers consist mainly of peasant farmers from areas that are currently battlegrounds for the joint Uganda-DRC attacks on the ADF rebels in the northeastern DRC forests. Senyondo Francis is the deputy chief administrative officer of Bundibugyo Border District. He told VOA that the district has been recording 60 to 100 new asylum seekers daily since the launch of the Uganda-DRC joint attacks. He said security checkpoints have been mounted to prevent the infiltration of rebels disguising as asylum seekers.
We have created a security team which has DSO, RDC, chairman and other agencies that is doing the preliminary screening of the new entrants camp. And even right now, as I talk to you right now, they are there screened because we want to have the right people in our hands in the camp.
Residents of border districts have also been alerted to be extra cautious as they welcome asylum seekers. Julius Akiza is the Albertine Regional Police spokesperson. He says many asylum seekers usually cross to Uganda using Lake Albert. Akiza says residents have been sensitized to present any asylum seekers in their communities to the responsible authorities for proper documentation and follow-up.
At the end of the year, we always register cases of influx, people from Congo due to maybe insecurity, but guerrilla fighting. Remember last year, we registered the number of influx. Since we have ADF within, we don't know the people that are coming in. Maybe those ones, the refugees may come in, may purport to be refugees that they are. So we call the general public to be extra vigilant. And now we shall have to thorough check the bags of all the new entrants when that. Remember, we are at the policy borders.
Area leaders are calling for resources to resettle the asylum seekers, most of whom are camped at schools, which reopen soon. Richard Gafabsa is a member of parliament in Bundibugyo Border District. He says the increasing number of asylum seekers is overwhelming local authorities. Gafabsa is afraid the congestion at the reception centers is a big health risk for the refugees and host communities.
Apart from the usual challenges we face when we have refugees, this time we have an additional challenge where we are struggling with the spread of the deadly COVID-19. So if we don't get support, we may end up getting a much more bigger challenge than we are having now.
Uganda is home to about 1.5 million refugees and asylum seekers, mostly from South Sudan and the DRC. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
The Zimbabwe government is poised to award Liberation War veterans U.S. dollar bonuses in a bid to improve their benefits. The former fighters say the current proposals do not go far enough. Eddie Gando has more on the story from the country's second largest city, Bulawayo.
The move follows a recent demonstration by the war veterans who picketed at the offices of Finance Minister Mthuli Ncube over what they say are their paltry allowances. Last week, at a strategic planning session for top military leaders, the Minister of Defense and War Veterans Affairs, Minister Opam Chinguri Kashiri, revealed that veterans will receive end-of-year bonuses issued in United States dollars. His announcement is seen by some observers as harsh money to increasingly restless war vets who feel left out of the exorbitant allowances benefiting highly connected elites and their families. Levi Maihlome is the legislator for rural Umzingwane district and a retired soldier and war vet. Last week in parliament, he urged government to pay pensioners, including war veterans, a minimum of US$200 monthly as a buffer against the high cost of living. He revealed that monthly social security pensions, which were increased from US$15 to $45 and are now going to be US$60 per month, are not enough. Economists and analysts, however, say a lasting solution to the problem needs to be found for the veterans to avoid an incident similar to one that took place in 1997. That's when the late deposed President Robert Mugabe was forced to agree to the demands of the former freedom fighters. They insisted on a gratuity of $50,000 each, which caused the Zimbabwean dollar to collapse against the US dollar and other major currencies. Observers say the aftershocks of the massive and unbudgeted expenditure are still being felt today. Meanwhile, civil servants whose calls for US dollar salaries have repeatedly been rejected by government are set to receive a one-time only payment. The government announced that its 300,000-strong civil service workforce will receive a single round of U.S. dollar bonuses of between $80 and $100. In a statement last Monday, the Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Unions criticized the payment as being piecemeal. Takawa Firajo of the Progressive Teachers Union of Zimbabwe concurs, saying that their demands are not far-fetched since the economy is essentially re-dollarized.
Our struggle as educators has never been on the payment of a US dollar denominated bonus, but the restoration of the purchasing power parity of teachers' salaries pegged at US$540. We are aware that economics would think that would not argue well with the economy, but our perception and our view is that we have a strong economy, which if tapped and harnessed properly, particularly the resources of both natural and human beings, they can afford us to live a better life.
Observers and stakeholders such as Joe insist that it is government's responsibility to create a conducive environment for the economy to thrive. Economist Gift Ngano agrees that it could do well if properly managed.
We have the highest tax regime in the continent, if not in the world, where close to 30% of our budget is funded from the gross domestic product, which is quite massive. It means the economy is not given space to breathe. People are being taxed heavily. You can think of your 2% tax, taking all the money from people, and then try to balance the budget deficit, which is a kind of providing stability. So you are making people poor. Eventually, you have a situation where the majority of the people now are now in poverty, right? The latest figures released by the World Bank in June in the economic update report from the World Bank shows that 49% of Zimbabweans are in extreme poverty. They are living on less than $1.90 per day.
Mugano says the situation is worsened for Zimbabweans.
Right, and that is 49%. Zimbabweans might want to know that in 2018, 29% of Zimbabweans were in poverty. So what it means is that between the last 2 years, under what the current dispensation is claiming that they've made progress, 20% of the population has entered into poverty, right? That's quite massive and worrying, and the government must have sleepless nights. You can't sleep when about half of your population, 7.9 million people, are in poverty, extreme poverty.
Mugano and others describe the prevailing socioeconomic situation as a disaster, all the more so because of yawning inequalities and the shrinking value of wages due to hyperinflation. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.